So right now, your phone can render a completely photorealistic 3D world in real time.
Oh yeah, instantly.
Right, just stretching and spinning and squashing millions of shapes every single second. And the crazy part is, it's doing all of that using the exact same boring, rigid grid of numbers that you probably completely dreaded in high school algebra.
Matrix.
Exactly, a matrix. I mean, most of us, when we hear that word, we have this immediate reflex to just picture a massive, lifeless spreadsheet.
Oh, totally. It feels like accounting.
Yeah, you just plug the numbers in, crunch them, and
Well,
well, you just hope you don't make a typo.
right. It feels very static, very flat, and, entirely disconnected from the physical world. But welcome to today's deep dive, because the text we are exploring today, it's called Geometric Thinking About Matrices. It completely shatters that whole spreadsheet illusion.
It really does. And the mission for this deep dive is to completely change how you view a matrix. We are turning abstract algebra into shapes and like physical movements.
And we have to set the stakes here, because this perspective isn't just some academic exercise. It is literally the absolute skeleton key to understanding practical machine learning. I mean, we were talking about the mechanics of how models compress massive data sets, how they categorize human behavior, and, like you mentioned, how they render cutting-edge graphics. You just cannot grasp modern ML until you stop seeing matrices as spreadsheets and start seeing them as spatial engines.
Spatial engines. I love that. So, for anyone listening who has ever felt overwhelmed by the sheer wall of math and machine learning, this is your aha moment.
Absolutely.
But to build this new universe, we have to start with the foundational materials, right? The text begins with this concept of a vector space.
Right. So a vector space is basically the arena where all of this geometric magic happens.
Yeah.
Simply put, it's just a collection of objects, vectors that can be added together and scaled by numbers.
And when you do that, the result just stays inside of that same arena.
Exactly. And vectors don't just have to be, those little arrows pointing in a direction on a graph. They can be columns of data, entire matrices, or even functions. As long as they follow those rules of addition and scaling, they belong in the space.
Okay, so the standard example the text gives is the space of all column vectors filled with real numbers. If we are standing inside this arena, what are we actually doing with these vectors?
Well, the text highlights the linear combination, and it calls this the fundamental building block of linear algebra.
Right.
A linear combination is wonderfully simple in practice. You just take a set of vectors, you scale each one by some number, which we call a coefficient, and you add them all up.
Okay.
But here is the really crucial insight from the reading. Every single time you multiply a matrix by a vector, you are just performing a linear combination.
Wait, really? Every time?
Every single time. The result is just a combination of the columns of the matrix
Yeah.
and that vector you multiplied by. It's just providing the instructions. It's the scaling coefficients telling you exactly how much of each column to use.
Okay, let's visualize this for the listener. Think of vectors as like primary colors of paint.
Oh, that's a great way to look at it.
Yeah, so a linear combination is literally just mixing paint. The vectors are the specific tubes of color you bought at the hardware store. Say a specific red, a specific blue, and a yellow.
Right.
And the coefficients, the scaling numbers you mentioned, are just how many drops of each color you decide to squeeze into the bucket.
Exactly. And the entire universe of colors that you can possibly mix from those specific tubes, that is what the text calls the span.
The span, got it.
Yeah. So if you only buy red paint, your span is severely restricted. It's just a single line of different shades of red. You can make it darker or lighter, but
You're stuck on the red line.
you're completely stuck.
Yeah.
But if you buy red and blue, assuming they're truly different colors,
Yeah.
your span suddenly becomes a flat plane. You can mix any shade of purple, pink, or navy.
And if you have enough distinct colors in a given space, you span the entire color wheel. You can reach any possible point.
Precisely. So the columns of a matrix are tubes of paint. The span of those columns is the column space.
Okay, so the text lays down this golden rule about solving equations. Like, if you have a system where you want to reach a target destination, like a specific target vector, you can only solve that system if your target lives inside the matrix's column space.
Right. Think about the paint. If your target vector is neon green, but the column space of your matrix only spans reds and blues.
You can't mix it.
Mathematically, it does not matter how you mix them. You simply cannot create green. The system has no solution because the destination is completely outside the reality your matrix can reach.
Okay, so what happens if I accidentally buy a color I can already mix? Like, say I buy a red blue and then I buy a purple that is just a perfect 50-50 mix of the red and blue I already have. Does the math just break?
You've just described linear dependence.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's basically a measure of geometric inefficiency. A set of vectors is linearly dependent if at least one of them is completely redundant. Yeah. It's just a combination of the vectors you already have, so it contributes absolute zero new direction to your span.
So you paid for three tubes of paint, but geometrically you really only have two.
Exactly.
You've completely wasted a dimension.
You really have. And this is exactly why the text introduces the concept of a basis. For a set of vectors to be a true basis for a space, it has to do two things. First, it has to span the space, meaning you have enough paint to mix every color.
Right.
And second, it must be linearly independent. So no redundant tubes of paint. The dimension of the space is just the number of vectors in that perfect non-redundant basis.
Okay, but the text gives a very specific warning here about machine learning, specifically regarding covariance matrices. It says that if a covariance matrix has linearly dependent columns, like if it has those redundant tubes of paint, it becomes singular. It cannot be inverted.
Yeah, so a covariance matrix in ML looks at how different features in your data vary together. If it's singular or non-invertible, it means the mathematical operation only goes one way.
Meaning what, exactly?
Meaning you can mix the paint, but you can never unmix it.
Yeah.
You lose the ability to trace a result back to its unique origin.
Yeah.
Because that redundant purple, it could have come from the purple tube, or it could have been mixed from the red and blue.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the math just hits a brick wall. In many classical algorithms, if you can't invert the matrix, the model simply crashes.
Wait, I'm confused then. You just said linear dependence breaks the math, makes the matrix singular, and crashes the model.
Right.
But the text also explicitly points out that principal component analysis PCA, which is like one of the most famous algorithms in data science, it actually relies on this exact linear dependence. How can it be a fatal bug and a celebrated feature at the exact same time?
Well, it depends entirely on what the algorithm is actually trying to achieve. If you blindly feed redundant, highly correlated data into an algorithm that strictly requires matrix inversion, like certain types of linear regression, yeah, it's a fatal bug.
Okay.
But PCA is doing something completely different. PCA is a data compression tool. It actively looks for that redundancy.
How does it actually do that, though? Unpack the mechanism for us.
Sure. Imagine you have a massive data set of human bodies.
Hmm.
You have height in inches, height in centimeters, and arm span. And you plot this in a 3D space.
Okay, three variables, three dimensions.
Right. But height in inches and height in centimeters are perfectly correlated. They're the exact same information, just scaled differently.
Mm-hmm.
And even arm span is highly correlated with height. So while your data is technically plotted in three dimensions, all the actual points form a flat 2D pancake tilted inside that 3D space.
Because that third dimension isn't providing any new geometric direction. It's literally just a redundant tube of paint.
Exactly. So PCA calculates the covariance matrix, looks at the geometry, and realizes the data is linearly dependent. It finds the axes where the data actually spreads out, the principal components, and literally rotates the mathematical perspective so that the flat pancake aligns with a 2D plane.
Oh, I see.
And then it just drops the useless third dimension entirely. It strips the redundant paint tube right out of the data set. You go from tracking three variables to two without losing the actual shape of the data.
It turns a bug into a massive compression feature.
Exactly. It simplifies the geometry, which is, you know, pretty essential when you're dealing with millions of parameters instead of just three.
That is brilliant. It literally searches for the wasted dimensions and throws them in the trash so the computer doesn't have to carry them around. Saves processing power, saves memory.
Right. So we've covered the structure of the space, the span, and the dimensions. Now the text transitions from what the space is to how we actively manipulate it.
Right.
Because matrices aren't just descriptions of space.
Right, they're actions, they're verbs.
Yes. This is the central, most beautiful insight of linear algebra. Every single matrix corresponds to a linear transformation. When you multiply a vector by a matrix, you aren't just doing arithmetic, you are actively morphing the space itself.
The matrix is basically a machine that grabs the space and alters it.
Exactly. And the text walks through the specific geometric operations these machines perform. You have rotation matrices filled with sines and cosines that spin the space around a pivot point.
Okay.
You have scaling matrices, which stretch or squish the axes independently. You have projection matrices, which take a 3D space and completely flatten it down into a 2D shadow. And reflection matrices, which just flip the space like a mirror.
So to tie this directly to cutting-edge machine learning, the text highlights a technique called 3D Gaussian splatting.
Oh, this is so cool.
Yeah, this is how incredibly fast, ultra-realistic 3D rendering is being done right now. Instead of calculating millions of complex, rigid polygons to build a scene, the algorithm uses these fuzzy, 3D spherical blobs called Gaussians.
Right, and the math relies entirely on these transformation matrices we just talked about.
Exactly. The covariance matrix of one of these 3D shapes is actually decomposed into a very specific equation. It's a rotation matrix multiplied by a scaling matrix multiplied by another rotation.
So rather than trying to build a complex shape from scratch, the algorithm just takes a generic spherical blob and applies an instruction manual.
Yeah.
The scaling matrix squishes the sphere into a flat oval, and the rotation matrix spins it into the exact right angle to become, say, a leaf on a tree or a brick in a wall.
It's matrix multiplication happening millions of times a second to spin and squish data into a visual reality. It is pure, high-speed geometric transformation.
Let's actually expand on this idea of morphing space, right? Because it's not just for graphics. It's the core of how neural networks learn.
Okay, let's hear it.
Think of the vector space as a giant ball of raw dough sitting on a counter. Inside this dough, baked right in, are red M&Ms and blue M&Ms, completely mixed up together.
Okay, I'm with you.
The red M&Ms represent one category of data, maybe pictures of cats, and the blue are pictures of dogs. And the goal of a classification algorithm is to draw a single straight line that perfectly separates the red from the blue.
But when they are all mixed up inside the dough like that, a straight cut is literally impossible.
Right, so what does the neural network do? The matrix weights in the network are just instruction manuals for the baker. The first layer's matrix tells the baker to take a rolling pin and stretch the dough.
Oh.
The next layer adds a fold. The next layer's matrix squishes it down. As the network trains, it's updating its matrices, learning the exact perfect sequence of how to stretch, twist, and morph that data dough, until suddenly, all the red M&Ms have been warped to the left side and all the blue are on the right.
Oh, wow. And then the final layer can just make one simple straight knife cut to classify the data perfectly.
Exactly. Morphing the space until the data is linearly separable. That is exactly what deep neural networks are doing geometrically.
That's incredible. But if we are going to stretch and warp space that intensely, we need to understand how the math keeps things organized, right? Which brings us to orthogonality and the hidden subspaces.
Yes.
Because when a matrix transforms space, the text explains that it creates these different mathematical, like, rooms. We've talked about the column space, the span of the columns. Then there's the row space, and finally, the null space.
The null space is fascinating. It is the set of all vectors that the matrix completely crushes down to zero.
Just obliterates them.
Totally. When the transformation happens, anything in the null space gets collapsed entirely into the origin point. And the text notes something mathematically elegant here. The null space and the row space are orthogonal complements.
Okay, let's unpack that word, orthogonal. The text defines it as two vectors having an inner product of zero. But in plain English, it's just the generalized mathematical term for being perfectly perpendicular, right?
Yes, exactly. Perpendicularity is scaled up to any dimension. If the null space and row space are orthogonal complements, it means every single piece of data that gets crushed to zero is perfectly perpendicular to every piece of data in the row space.
So they exist in completely separate, non-overlapping geometric realities.
Right. The matrix sweeps everything in the null space into the trash compactor, while everything in the row space actually survives the transformation.
Man. And the text takes this concept of perpendicularity and introduces the ultimate holy grail of mathematical neatness, orthonormal bases. This is a setup where your vectors are all perfectly perpendicular to each other, and they all have a unit length of exactly one.
And if you build a square matrix out of these orthonormal columns, it's called an orthogonal matrix. These matrices are incredibly special. They act like rigid, perfect glass.
Like they never stretch or squish the dough.
Exactly. They only represent pure rotations and reflections. They preserve the lengths of vectors and the angles between them with absolute perfection.
See, the text mentions that an orthonormal basis is maximally convenient because it makes computing coordinates effortless. It makes the math clean.
Oh, very clean.
But let's look at the real world for a second. Real human data, real image data, is incredibly messy. It's noisy, things are highly correlated, nothing naturally sits at a perfect 90-degree angle.
Mm.
So are we using orthonormal matrices in machine learning because they actually reflect the hidden truth of the real world? Or are we just forcing this artificial geometric perfection onto the data because it prevents the computer's math from breaking?
That is a great question.
Yeah.
And it is entirely about computational survival.
Really?
Yeah. You are absolutely right that raw data is a messy, correlated web. But think back to the dough analogy. If a deep neural network has 100 layers, that means the data is being subjected to 100 consecutive matrix multiplications.
Oh, right.
If those matrices are constantly stretching and squishing the space uncontrollably, your numbers will exponentially compound. The math will literally explode into infinity or will just vanish to zero. This is a notorious problem in deep learning.
Right, the vanishing and exploding gradient problem.
Exactly. So we mathematically force the data into orthonormal bases. Because orthogonal matrices act like they're rigid glass, perfectly preserving lengths and angles, they act as a stabilizing force.
So they let us rotate and examine the data without it warping out of control.
Right. It's not a reflection of the raw data's natural state. It's a computational necessity. We strictly enforce the rigid geometry so the algorithm can actually survive the journey through 100 layers of processing.
We use geometric discipline to tame the chaos of the real world.
Precisely.
Wow. So let's step back and look at the whole picture. For you listening, a matrix should no longer be a static spreadsheet. It is a dynamic geometric engine.
It really is.
It uses linear combinations of primary colors to build vast spans of possible realities. It uses concepts of dimension to find redundant data so algorithms like PCA can compress massive data sets. And most importantly, it acts as a shapeshifter, a machine to stretch, rotate, and fold space.
Which is the exact mechanism that allows a neural network to unravel complex data and allows a rendering engine to instantly morph blobs into 3D visual reality.
It's a complete paradigm shift in how you visualize the mathematics running our modern technology.
It is. And actually, there's a final thought based on the geometry we've discussed today that really highlights the real-world stakes of these transformations.
Oh, let's hear it.
So we talked about projection matrices earlier, the transformations that squash a 3D space down into a flat 2D shadow.
Right.
The text mentions that projection matrices are idempotent. Mathematically, that means if you apply the matrix twice, the result is exactly the same as applying it once.
Okay, what does that mean geometrically?
Geometrically, it means that once you project a 3D object down into a 2D shadow, projecting that shadow again does absolutely nothing. The depth is gone. The change is permanent. You cannot unflatten the shadow to recreate the object.
The shadow forgets the shape that cast it.
Completely. And it made me think about the machine learning models that are constantly projecting our incredibly high-dimensional, complex human lives into lower-dimensional categories.
Oh.
Yeah. Algorithms project thousands of nuanced behavioral traits down into a flat 2D consumer profile or a risk score. Think about that the next time you interact with a system that categorizes you. Once your complex, multidimensional life is flattened by an idempotent projection, what vital context about who you are gets trapped forever in the null space?
Because anything in the null space gets crushed to zero.
Exactly. What nuances are perfectly, permanently crushed to zero, unable to ever be mathematically recovered by the machine?
That is a heavy realization. The math is incredibly elegant, but the consequences of what gets swept into the trash compactor are very real.
Very real.
Well, next time you open a spreadsheet and see those rigid rows and columns, don't just see numbers waiting to be crunched. Ask yourself, what shape is this matrix about to bend, and what reality is it about to permanently crush?